Welcome to Financial Peace University, Lesson 8, Real Estate and Mortgages.
Please welcome Dave Ramsey.
Woo! Yeah! Awesome! Awesome! Thank you. How many of you are like me? You've been on a great vacation, or maybe a not-so-great vacation where you traveled. Or maybe you were traveling for work. I travel a lot. I speak all over the world and do a lot of media appearances and everything. So traveling. And how many of you know what I'm talking about? When you travel like that and you come home, it's good to be home. There's nothing like that word. That word is emotional. That word touches our spirit. Home. Say it with me.
Home.
Jesus said, "The foxes have holes and the birds have nests, but the Son of Man has no place to lay his head." When we as Christians start talking about heaven, we talk about going home. We talk about that sometimes at a funeral. We call it a homecoming or a homegoing. And the idea of home is rooted in our spirits. It's rooted in who we are. And so as we talk about real estate and mortgages tonight, I want you to think about home as more than just a financial transaction. Because I am convinced one of the reasons that we in America have prospered so financially is we are actually the very first culture in the history of the world that the average typical citizen owns real estate. And that sense of stability, that sense of home, the aristocracy, the wealthy in most cultures of the world were the only ones that owned their homes. In our culture, it's normal to own your home. Now, maybe with a mortgage, but you own it. You control it. There's this sense of spiritual, emotional, relational stability from which you're able to go out and do things economically. And I think that's one of the reasons, spiritually, that America has prospered, is we have home. Say it again.
Home.
And the great American dream is home ownership. You know, if you ask people, what's the great American dream? They often say either owning your own business or owning your own home. And yet, if you do this home ownership thing wrong, it's such a huge transaction that it becomes not the great American dream, but instead the great American nightmare. I mean, it's not a blessing, it's a curse. It's not a good thing, it's a problem. It's not a thing that causes me to have peace in my family. It causes stress in my family when it's done improperly and in the wrong order. And things aren't laid out the way they're supposed to be. The numbers don't crunch properly. So we're going to walk through that in this lesson to make sure that we get this right. Now let's review the baby steps right quick. Baby step one is $1,000. Say it again. Baby step two then is we're going to work the debt snowball where we pay off our debts, smallest to largest in that order. Baby step two is the debt snowball. Say baby step two. Baby step three is we're going to finish the emergency fund with 3 to 6 months of expenses set aside. We talked about that in the super savings lesson, and that's a fully funded emergency fund. Say 3 to 6.
3 to 6.
Then baby step four is 15% of your income is going into retirement. Baby step five is kids' college. And then that's going to bring us to this real estate lesson with baby step six, which is pay off your home early. Now, I will tell you that the average family going through Financial Peace University, the average family listening to me on the radio that writes me and tells me their story or read the book, The Total Money Makeover, and writes me and tells me their story, the anecdotal evidence and some of the actual research that we have gives us this. It usually takes about a month to get that first $1,000 set aside. It takes about 18 to 24 months to get, on average, all of your debts paid off except your home in baby step two. Baby step three is finish the emergency fund. That usually takes another 6 months or so. So 2-3 years to get through those first three baby steps. Here's what's interesting. By the time we get to baby step six, we're seeing families that are participating in this with focus, with intentionality, working together as a couple, as we've taught you, for those of you that are married, working with accountability for those of you that are single, we're seeing them pay off their home on average in about 7 years. Now, that means that some people are taking 12 or 15, and some people are doing it really, really fast because their home was almost paid for. But the average is running about 7 years to get through baby step six. Now, how do we do this? Again, intentionality with our money. Making the money behave, giving every dollar an assignment, and that means we're doing the budget every month before the month begins for the rest of our lives. And especially while you're in the class, you're working the budget forms, you're bringing them in, you're showing your coordinator, you're being accountable, you're being held accountable in that process, and it causes you to shift your behavior to where you're looking forward with your money instead of looking back going, where'd it went? Where'd it go? Where'd it go? And so that's how this is happening. Now, let's first talk about renting, because there's a lot of misnomers about renting. Automatically, when someone says so-and-so is a renter, so-and-so is renting, we immediately think, oh, they shouldn't be doing that. They ought to buy. That is not true. Not everyone at every situation should buy right then. We want to get ourselves in order so that we do buy a home, but buying a home out of order becomes a problem rather than a blessing. So, when do we rent? There's nothing wrong with renting for a little while. This demonstrates patience and wisdom. As an example, I recommend when a young couple first gets married that the first thing they do is they wait a year to buy. They need to spend that year piling up cash, getting all their baby steps worked out, getting on the same page, learning to work together. And I always joke, but it's not much of a joke to tell that young couple when they first get married, it takes a year of marriage to know how close to your mother-in-law to buy. And we all kind of laugh at that, but there's some truth to that actual statement. But what we're saying is we got to know how to work together on things. And we've got to know that before we make a home purchase. So that's an example when you're being patient and you're waiting and it's a good thing to rent. Another example would be if something bad happened, like maybe you went through a divorce or you were widowed or you're a widower, you lost your spouse. In the middle of that grief, in the middle of all that pain, you don't make a decision to buy a house. But I you wouldn't believe the number of people I talk to who feel tremendous emotional pressure by the culture to go rush and buy something because somehow that's going to stabilize all this pain. That's going to fix everything. And it does just the opposite because you make really bad decisions when you're in the middle of that much pain, when you're in the middle of all this turmoil in your life. Not the time to make a decision. Another example would be a military family. They're only in that location for a couple of years. Very seldom does that home go up enough in value that they can sell it, and so they're stuck with it. And then they go do it again, they're stuck with it. And they go do it again, they're stuck with it. And they've got rental properties dotted all over the United States because they got stuck with them each time, because they didn't own them long enough to be able to sell them for a profit. So there's times that renting is a good idea. It's when it's temporary. Another time is sometimes when you move to a new city. It's not a bad idea to rent for a year and get to know the neighborhoods. Otherwise, you're kind of blindfolded when you're looking. Now, you can make a decision and you can go visit and study, and some people are able to do that if they move more, but I really want to know which side of the tracks things are, and I kind of want to know where the tracks are. You know, I want to know where I'm landing with this stuff. And so those are times that it is patience and wisdom as a temporary measure to rent until we get a solid foundation under us. When are you ready to buy? You're not ready to buy until you get through baby step three. That means you should be debt-free and have your emergency fund in place. Now, sometimes people stop right there, and in addition to their emergency fund, baby step three, they start saving for their down payment. We call that baby step 3B. Before they start retirement and college and that other stuff, they start piling up their down payment right there. That's a really good place to do that. But don't move into a home with 62 debts or 6 debts or 2 debts and no money. You move into a home broke with a bunch of debt around your neck, Murphy will move in your spare bedroom, bring his 3 cousins, broke, desperate, and stupid. They will live with you. Your life will look like a country song. Everything that can go wrong will. I mean, it is unbelievable what you'll be facing. You're asking for it when you move into a home broke. Now, why would we buy a home at all? Well, there's a lot of great benefits for home ownership. The first one is it's a forced savings plan. When you buy a home and you put down a good down payment, maybe you take out a mortgage, maybe you don't, but you're paying payments. If you're paying those monthly payments, as you're paying them, some of that's interest and some of that is reducing the principal. And so you're getting more and more equity in the home. You have a forced savings plan, and you can't get that money out easy. It's kind of locked in there. And so it causes you to build wealth. It's a great forced savings plan. The second thing is it's an inflation hedge. Now, in the last several decades, we haven't had a lot of inflation. I mean, but back in 1978 when I got my real estate license, that year, the inflation rate for real estate, residential real estate in our area and in most areas of the United States was around 12%. Houses were going up 10, 12% a year. $200,000 house a year later is worth 2.25. I mean, that's wild. That's a couple of grand a month that thing's going up. And now we haven't seen that kind of inflation in a while. But if you own a home and that kind of inflation takes place, you're riding the wave up. If you don't own it and that kind of inflation takes place, you can get crushed by that wave. And so it's an inflation hedge because you participate in the one of the big components of what is inflation. It'd be like owning an oil company while gas went up, right? You know, you'd be on the right side of that equation then for a change. And that's what an inflation hedge is. The second thing is, or the third thing is, your house grows virtually tax-free. Your personal residence grows virtually tax-free. A personal residence under current tax law at the time of this shooting, you, as a married couple, married filing jointly, you can make up to $500,000 profit if you've owned the house 2 years or more. Tax-free. No taxes on it. You don't have to reinvest it. You don't have to buy another house. All those rules are years and years old. Just simply profit is yours up to $500,000. $250,000 for a single person. And so that's tax-free growth. That's pretty substantial. That's a big deal that you got that as an option in there. Now, what do we buy? When we start thinking about actually buying, we've gotten our emergency fund in place. We're out of debt. We're clarified how we're getting at this. We think it's a good idea to buy. What are we going to buy? Well, you want to buy in the bottom price range of the neighborhood. The bottom price range of the neighborhood, and never overbuild your neighborhood through home additions or improvements. So if you're looking at a home that's $400,000 and all the other homes in the neighborhood are $300,000, wrong. You want to be on the other end of that. As a matter of fact, if you could slip down under that $1.99 psychology, if the average home in the neighborhood is 3 to 3.25 and you could get something in the 280s or 290s, you're going to see the most appreciation from the bottom to the middle range of the neighborhood. Don't buy the most expensive home in that neighborhood, because when you get ready to resell, people aren't coming to that neighborhood to look for that price range. And if you buy a home and you add so much to it that now you have to get half again what the whole area is bringing just to get your money out, you've overbuilt the neighborhood, and you don't want to do that either. Homes appreciate in good neighborhoods and are priced based on three things, according to my appraisal teacher in college, and I think he's right. He says three things cause you to have value: location, location, and location. You can take a house trailer, a double wide, and sit it in the middle of a cornfield in Ohio, and it's worth $3,000. You can set it somewhere in Mississippi or in Tennessee, and it's worth $3,000. But if you set it on a 100-by-100 piece of sand right next to Malibu Beach, it's worth $1.2 million. Has everything to do with the location of what you're dealing with. When you get ready to buy, if you have the opportunity to, buy near water or buy something with a view. These are great things for resale. And really, it's funny to me how much you can get away with when you call it a view. Some of you people live in an area where it's just pancake flat, and any little bump is called a hill. And that house is on a view. You know what I'm saying? And it's amazing to me what people call water. I have seen some creeks that look suspiciously like drainage ditches. And the name of the street was Creekside. There wasn't a creek there. That was a drainage ditch. It's a wet weather creek, though, right? What? And the way the market perceives it is huge. This is huge. Buy bargains by learning to overlook things that can be fixed, like bad landscaping, ugly carpet, outdated wallpaper, and the Elvis print in the master bedroom. Some of you go through, and the other owner's decorating turns you off. That's not a reason not to buy a house. That's a reason to get a great deal on a house, because the average buyer has no imagination. So you need to go through and be able to look past that. You remember that shag carpet that you like needed a rake? You remember that? And you had to rake it a certain way, like your hair or something. It had to go a certain direction. It was like a comb over, but with carpet, you know? And you know, if it's got that in there, it's old, okay? And old carpet is not retro. It's just old carpet. Old tile might be retro. We can bring it back, right? But that there's nothing cool about old carpet. And so you need to overlook things that can be replaced quickly and easily like that. I used to buy real estate for a living and buy and sell for a living before I went broke. And I remember one time right after I went broke, I found a bargain. And this little couple that was in my Sunday school class at church, they wanted to buy a house. And so this is a long time ago. I found a great deal on this house. It was about $140,000, $160,000 house. And I was able to buy it for $60,000. But it was unbelievably poorly decorated. The worst paint colors, the worst carpet you've ever seen in your life. But I'm talking, you know, almost $100,000 off on the price, right? And they go over there and they're walking around and they're wringing their hands and they're thinking about it. And she comes out and she says, "We just can't buy it." "Why?" "I don't care, but I'm curious. Why?" We don't like the carpet. It's $100,000 under market. Do you want to carpet the whole neighborhood? We can carpet the roof. I mean, anything you want to carpet for that. Just visualize ripping the carpet out. But she couldn't get past that. Didn't have the imagination to take a bargain. That's how you do it. You need to look past that kind of stuff and get yourself a bargain. Always buy a home that is or can be attractive from the street and has a good floor plan. I bought a house here in Tennessee one time. My very first home, as a matter of fact. I got a great deal on it. You know why? It was ugly. It was ugly to the bone. It was so ugly. It was on the side of a little hill on this little subdivision lot, and then he built like this thing that just stuck up there like a sore thumb. It was so nasty bad. You know the kind of house I'm talking about. And had a little driveway ran straight up to it. It was so steep that when you got to the bottom, you had to turn to keep your car from dragging. You know what I'm talking about. And one night I came home in an ice storm and I was trying to walk across that driveway. My parents were over visiting, watching the kids. The kids were little. And I slipped and I fell and I hit the driveway and I did Ninja Turtle all the way to the bottom. And I'm yelling and saying things you can't say in church. And my mother looks out the window and says to my wife, "Somebody's playing on your driveway." And you don't want to buy an ugly house like this, okay? You want to buy something that's got good bones to it and has a good solid floor plan. I had a house one time that was a rental house, had four bedrooms, but you had to go through one of the bedrooms to get to the other bedroom. Who was not thinking when they built this? These are two old boys that did the architecture on a brown bag on the hood of their pickup or something here, right? It was a bad idea. So if it's got bad bones, you can't fix that. You can fix the Elvis print and you can get rid of the shag carpet. Now, how do we buy? Real estate agents have full access to the multiple listing service, the MLS, and this can make house hunting really, really easy today. 89% of the buyers last year bought a home through a quality realtor. And so you want a professional if you're going to be working on the buyer or the selling side when you're dealing in the real estate world. It's a big deal. And search for a home using the internet listings. Stats are telling us right now that 90% of the people look for a home online and do online shopping. And so that's what you're doing as a buyer. And you need to remember that 89% of the buyers use a real estate agent ultimately before they do the purchase. But they shop on the internet. Now, if you're buying and you're shopping on the internet, I want you to make sure that you look past some of those people's ugly pictures, because some of those houses are better than they look on the internet. And that might be an opportunity for you to find a bargain because everyone else ruled it out based on their ugly picture. And it turns out it's a pretty nice place. It's just their realtor is not a very good photographer. When you buy a piece of property that is not a traditional subdivision lot, always get a survey. Always get a land survey if you're buying something that's not a standard subdivision lot. Now, some of you people live in areas of the country that when I fly over it, it looks like a little checkerboard, and it's all pretty and nice. I'm in Tennessee. The surveys in Tennessee read something like, "Starts at an old oak tree and goes to a pile of rocks, neither one of which are still there." And so you have to figure this thing out. And the last three generations of relatives have been exaggerating every generation. It really is about 20 acres. By the time it gets around to them exaggerating it, it's now up to 40. And so you really do need to have it surveyed to really know what you're getting into. And if you're buying a home, always have a professional home inspector structurally certify the home. Really get into it. Really see what it is. And there's nothing wrong with that. And sellers don't like it because they don't want to be nitpicked, but it'll keep you out of some huge messes like mold or roof leaks or heating and air systems that are on their last legs or those kinds of things. Because when you and I are buying, we get all excited about the house. We get house fever. And we tend to overlook some things that might be a little bit obvious. And you want to be wise. You want to have all the information to make your decisions with as you're buying it. Now, get an appraisal. Most of you, if you're getting a mortgage, you're going to be required to get an appraisal. But understand, an appraisal is an opinion of value. And some of these appraisers have been burnt by some of these economic turns and some of these bank laws and different things. And they're a little paranoid, some of them. And some of them are a little bit of a Barney Fife power trip. I was selling a piece of property a while back, and we had the contract written up for $262,500. And, of course, the appraiser got a copy of the contract. We also furnished the appraiser with all of the comparables in the area to make his job easy for him. And Mr. Power Trip comes back, not with $262,500. He appraised the house at $262,250. Like you know that close what this house is worth, you know. So, you know, it's an opinion. So be willing to push back, be willing to fight about that a little bit. But you do want an outside third party to tell you what the thing is worth because, again, we get house fever in the process. Title insurance insures you against an unclean title when your property ownership is called into question. Always buy title insurance. Circle that and put stars around it. Always, with any real estate you buy title insurance. Well, that's just one of those rip-off closing costs. That's just one of those fees they throw on there. Another way they make money on us. Yes, they make money on you. But I have bought foreclosures. I've owned over 1,000 pieces of property in my life. I've seen more title messed up than you can imagine. I bought a piece of property one time with title insurance, thank goodness, from an estate. The two sisters signed off on it. Somehow they forgot they had a brother. Maybe they thought he would never turn up. 2 years later, mystery brother shows up. Turns out I'm his new partner. And he wants me to sign off and give him money to get his signature to get the other third of the house. I don't have clean title. The three heirs hadn't all signed it. And there was some issues there. So what did I do? Well, normally, if I didn't have title insurance, I'd be a little freaked out and have to be handling all of this. Instead, I just called the title insurance company. They wrote Mystery Boy a check. He signed the stuff. No problems to me. This is why you get title insurance. They ensured that the title was clean, so they had to pay to make it clean when it wasn't. Always get title insurance.